Coming up, Kim Lawton looks at a clash of values as Republican and Democratic presidential candidates reach out to Jewish voters. And Tim O'Brien reports on a key issue before the Supreme Court about religious objections to the contraception mandate in the Affordable Care Act. Plus, as Western Christians celebrate Easter, the central role of flowers.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. Religious groups strongly condemned this week's terrorist attacks in Brussels. Pope Francis urged people to persevere in prayer. Francis also asked for the conversion of those blinded by cruel fundamentalism. A Muslim umbrella group in Belgium also condemned what it called acts of extreme cruelty against innocent civilians. Four Mormon missionaries were among the hundreds injured in the attacks. In the wake of the bombings, Republican presidential candidate Ted Cruz provoked controversy by advocating increased surveillance in Muslim neighborhoods. Muslims across the country and groups including the Council on American-Islamic Relations and the Jewish Anti-Defamation League condemned Cruz's statements. They noted that his comments followed a pattern of increased anti-Muslim rhetoric in the U.S. President Obama and Democratic presidential candidates Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders also said they strongly disagreed with Cruz. The Brussels attacks have added fuel to the already simmering debate about the migrant crisis in Europe. Tensions continue to rise in many border areas, especially in Greece, where thousands of migrants have been stranded because of border closures. This week, several aid groups said they were suspending their efforts in some centers where migrants have been detained. The groups accused the European Union of running roughshod over the rights of the migrants. This Holy Week for Western Christians, Pope Francis has put special focus on the plight of refugees. On Palm Sunday, he urged the world not to be indifferent to the desperate situations that many refugees face. In the traditional Holy Thursday service, Francis washed the feet of several refugees, including three Orthodox women from Eritrea, four Nigerian Catholics, a Hindu man, and Muslim men from Syria, Pakistan, and Mali. The Vatican said the gesture was meant to restore the refugees' human dignity. During his visit to Cuba this past week, President Obama thanked religious leaders, including Pope Francis, for the part they played in urging normalized relations between the U.S. and Cuba. In his speech, broadcast live throughout the island, Obama emphasized the importance of human rights, including religious freedom.
I believe that every person should have the freedom to practice their faith peacefully and publicly. And yes, I believe voters should be able to choose their governments in free and democratic elections.
A United Nations International Criminal Court this week convicted former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic of genocide and crimes against humanity. The atrocities were committed during the Bosnian War in the early 1990s. Among the killings was the 1995 massacre of 8,000 Muslim men and boys. Karadzic was sentenced to 40 years in prison. U.S. presidential candidates this week reached out to Jewish voters. They pledged their support for Israel at the annual conference in Washington of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC. Kim Lawton reports there were strong clashes over the role of Jewish values in politics.
The American Israel Public Affairs Committee is the nation's largest and most influential pro-Israel lobby group, and always a key stop for presidential candidates. Some 18,000 delegates attended this year's AIPAC meeting, where Democratic and Republican politicians talked about their positions on Middle East policy and other issues of concern to the Jewish community.
We must repudiate all efforts to malign, isolate, and undermine Israel and the Jewish people.
According to a 2014 Gallup poll, 61% of American Jews are Democrats. Many of the delegates here said their vote is based on Jewish values, especially the teaching that Jews are supposed to help repair the world, Tikkun Olam.
When I think about who I'm going to vote for and who I want to support and who I want to lead this country, it absolutely comes from the ideas of Tikkun Olam, comes from treat people how you want to be treated, do unto others, and also compromise.
Some delegates were frustrated that Bernie Sanders, the first Jewish presidential candidate, decided not to attend the meeting. He campaigned out west instead.
I think Bernie Sanders made a really bad political move. I think he would have had a big platform to speak, and people would have listened to him. I think people would have respected him more had he come out and not dissed AIPAC.
Still, there was strong admiration for Sanders among the delegates, no matter which candidate they support.
In some ways, I'm hard-pressed to be against a candidate who was bar mitzvahed and went to live in Israel for a while, and I have a tendency to like Bernie, and I like many of his ideals.
And it surely
it was
is
the
not
Republican side, and especially Donald Trump, that generated the most controversy. Several high-profile Jewish leaders boycotted Trump's speech. One of the boycott organizers, Florida Rabbi David Paskin, said Trump's campaign rhetoric against women, Muslims, and immigrants contradicts Jewish beliefs.
He's made bigotry and xenophobia a cornerstone of his campaign. And as religious leaders and as people of faith, we have an obligation to listen and then to say, enough. It's time to stand up. It's time to come together against this hatred.
While Trump was addressing the crowd, some assembled in the hallway to do Torah study instead.
America and Israel are built upon values, values of B'Tselem Elohim, everyone is created in the image of God, values of Kavod HaBriot, respect and honor due to all of God's creations. Those are the values that these countries are built on.
Trump did have supporters here, despite concerns about his rhetoric.
I think it's just his tactic. I don't necessarily agree with it. I wish that he would definitely calm down and tone it down a little bit and get a little bit more of a filter. But I think in general, I don't think he's anti-Semitic. His daughter is an Orthodox Jew.
Although Jewish voters are concerned about a wide range of issues, America's support for Israel remains the top priority for AIPAC members. Some in the Jewish community were troubled by recent statements Trump made, insisting that as president, he would remain neutral while trying to broker an Israeli-Palestinian peace deal.
We need steady hands. Not a president who says he's neutral on Monday, pro-Israel on Tuesday, and who knows what on Wednesday, because everything's negotiable.
In his address, Trump received several standing ovations as he pledged his unwavering support for Israel. He promised to crack down against Iran and to move the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem, which he called the eternal capital of the Jewish people.
When I'm president, believe me, I will veto any attempt by the UN to impose its will on the Jewish state. It will be vetoed 100%.
As the campaign moves forward, many here said it's vital that Jewish voters across the board continue to raise their voices in the process.
We think this is the precise moment when we have to speak up.
I'm Kim Lawton in Washington.
Meanwhile, this week, Israel revealed a successful covert operation to rescue 19 Jews from war-torn Yemen. The Yemeni Jews received a warm welcome inside Israel. They brought with them a 500-year-old Torah scroll. Jews have lived in predominantly Muslim Yemen for centuries, but many say the civil war there has taken a toll on their community. Israeli officials said about 50 Jews decided to stay in Yemen. This week, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments about a provision in the Affordable Care Act that requires employers to cover contraception services for their employees. Faith-based groups have been active on both sides of the issue. Many rallied outside the court as the justices heard the case, which involves several Catholic and evangelical nonprofits. Some faith groups argue that the mandate violates religious freedom, but other religious activists support the mandate as a matter of justice, saying employees should have easy access to birth control. Tim O'Brien has our report on the issues at stake.
It was the fourth Supreme Court challenge in the last 4 years to the Affordable Care Act, and with this one, as on all previous occasions, the divisions in the country over Obamacare were reflected in the divisions on the court's plaza.
Some employers want to use their religious beliefs to block women's access to birth control.
Yes, Jesus loves me.
The issue this time is similar to a case 2 years ago in which the court ruled that privately held firms do not have to provide coverage for contraception if doing so violates their religious convictions. The current case involves religiously affiliated nonprofits, schools, hospitals, and charities, such as the Little Sisters of the Poor, an order of Roman Catholic nuns devoted to serving the poor and the elderly. Founded in France 175 years ago, the order has 28 homes for the elderly in the United States. The Catholic faith pervades life at their home in Washington, D.C. They celebrate Mass every morning. And because of their faith and their belief that any form of contraception is a sin, the sisters do not have to directly provide contraception coverage to their employees. But they do have to make coverage available through a third party. They have to fill out and submit a government form identifying the insurance carrier and contact information. If that's too much, even a simple letter with the same information will do. It is an accommodation, but one the sisters reject.
There is an accommodation and we don't have to pay, that's true. But for us, it's never been a question of money. It's a question of participation in something that we consider a moral evil.
The sisters rely on a federal law, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, signed into law in 1993 by President Bill Clinton. The law says the government may not substantially burden a person's exercise of religion unless doing so is the least restrictive means to further some compelling government interest. We know that you and the Catholic Church are against this, but how does it affect your practice of your faith?
I think asking us to facilitate the provision of something that we consider morally objectionable, that's where it enters into the practice of our faith. Because practicing one's faith is not only a matter of worshiping in church or saying prayers, but it's in all the daily decisions of our lives. So how we conduct ourselves, it's not only a matter of what happens in church.
The sisters' lawsuit is one of seven consolidated cases heard by the court on Wednesday, all raising the same basic questions. Whether requiring the plaintiffs to sign off on contraception coverage, even though they don't have to pay for it, is still a substantial burden on their religious freedom. And if it is, might there be some other less offensive means of promoting women's health? The more liberal wing of the court appeared supportive of the government, Justice Sonia Sotomayor. When contraceptives are provided to women in a seamless way, the number of unintended pregnancies dramatically falls, as does the number of abortions. Justice Stephen Breyer observed that in a pluralistic society, religion can't trump everything. Think of the Quakers who object to Vietnam, or the people who object to shoveling the snow in front of an abortion clinic. The more conservative justices appear to be lining up behind the sisters. Justice Sam Alito was most supportive, noting that many religious groups, not just Catholics, have found the contraception mandate the greatest threat to religious liberty in this country. And Chief Justice John Roberts wondered out loud about how compelling the government's interest was, given that millions of Americans are exempt from the law for both religious and non-religious reasons.
If the government wants to provide these services, the government is free to provide them. And all the Little Sisters are asking today is that the government uses all of its other programs to provide the services it wants. The government today told the Supreme Court that it is not interested in an approach where there are two different plans. Instead, it wants to borrow the Little Sisters plan and make the sisters violate their beliefs. There's no reason to do that. This is a diverse country. It is very easy to provide these services without nuns.
Women deserve insurance coverage of birth control no matter where they work. This birth control benefit has been a game changer for women. It has advanced women's health, advanced women's equality, and it saved women over $1 billion in 1 year alone. These employers want to take that benefit away from their employees. The alternatives that they proposed in court today are unworkable and frankly insulting.
And you know, we Little Sisters of the Poor are a group of women who make religious vows to God. Now we find ourselves in a situation where the government is requiring us to make changes in our healthcare, our religious healthcare plan, to include services that really violate our deepest held religious beliefs as Little Sisters. You know, it's hard to understand why the government is doing this. There are one-third of Americans in our country that are not covered by this mandate. And, you know, there's large corporations such as Visa and Exxon, Pepsi, that are fully exempt from the mandate, but yet we are threatened, the government is threatening us with fines of over $70 million a year.
This case underscores the paralysis at the court on some issues after the death of Justice Antonin Scalia, who, given his history and ideology, would have been a likely vote for the sisters. Should the remaining eight justices split 4-4, the contraception mandate would stand in 22 states where it has been upheld by 7 federal appeals courts, but it would be invalid in the 7 states covered by the only appeals court to rule against the mandate and up for grabs in the remaining 21 states. The stakes are enormous for both sides, and at Mass last week, the Little Sisters of the Poor could be heard appealing to an even higher court. With the justices appearing equally divided, it may take some divine intercession for either side to pick up the crucial 5th vote. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Tim O'Brien in Washington.
Finally, as Western Christians are marking Easter, flowers are a familiar and much-loved feature of the celebrations. Kim Lawton looks at the symbolism of Easter flowers, as well as the concerns of one leader who urges Christians to make sure Easter is something more than just a spring festival.
It's Good Friday at Washington National Cathedral, and volunteers are getting ready for Easter Sunday. They've been preparing for weeks to help the congregation celebrate the most joyous day on the Christian calendar. Here and in churches around the world, flowers are a central part of Easter Sunday worship, symbolizing the rejoicing that comes with new life.
We've been through Lent, which can seem so long and so colorless, really. It's a black and white time. So we can't wait to get that color and the life back into the building.
At National Cathedral, Linda Reckline heads the Flower Guild as well as the Altar Guild. She's been helping to decorate the cathedral for more than 50 years. Given the size and architecture here, it's a huge job. A team of about 40 volunteers helps pull everything together for Easter. They follow special flower recipes that Reckline has created to decorate all over the building.
I make out a recipe for each location, and I design what flowers will go into that location and how many of everything I need.
Reckline sees it as a ministry.
Through the flowers, I've always wanted to help people see different things they had not seen before.
This year, a family has donated large branches from their backyard that Reckline will use as part of the decorations.
It came from outside. It's been outside waiting all winter to come into the cathedral.
She intends to attach vials of fresh flowers to the dead branches.
Perhaps orchids or gerberas or roses or something in it, and flowering spring-type branches, and make it look like a living tree.
I love to do that kind of thing, to reuse things, but in an imaginative way that sort of shows you life goes on and, you know, this sort of thread that goes through life.
For Christians, the idea of new life coming out of death is the resurrection. And for centuries, flowers, and especially lilies, have helped set the tone for Easter Sunday worship. But some leaders are concerned that on Easter, too many Christians want to go straight to celebrating the resurrection without having first adequately reflected on the crucifixion.
More and more, we just think of it in American culture as a festival of bunnies and flowers. What's missing is the profound struggle that Jesus underwent in order to take on the burden of sin and death. So Easter becomes a very thin, generic festival.
Reverend Fleming Rutledge was one of the first women ordained in the Episcopal Church. A nationally known preacher and teacher, she's released a new book called The Crucifixion. She calls it her life's work. Rutledge believes that preaching about the crucifixion has been sidelined in many American churches.
The cross is very ugly. It was designed to be ugly. It was designed to be dehumanizing. It was designed to be degrading. Since Jesus Christ gave up not only his life, but also made himself an object of scorn and shame, Christians need to understand that they too may be made figures of scorn and shame from time to time.
During the period of Lent, and especially during Holy Week, many churches shroud their crosses as a vivid reminder of death. Rutledge argues that in an era that has been marked by genocide and terrorism, it's imperative that Christians reflect on evil, suffering, and death.
There will be times of great joy, but there will also be times of great strain, testing, and sacrifice. To be able to face the absolute worst and come out still able to affirm the power of God to conquer sin is what I would wish for every Christian.
Focusing on the crucifixion, she believes, will make celebration of the resurrection all the sweeter.
It should be infinitely greater, more important, more profound, infinitely, almost indescribably.
Rutledge says she loves flowers in the church on Easter, and especially a tradition she grew up with known as flowering the cross, where fresh blooms are attached to wooden crosses. But she cautions that flowers eventually break down as a symbol of the resurrection.
Too much emphasis on flowers robs the event of its unrepeatable quality. Flowers coming up in the spring is not a miracle. It is a wonderful thing, but it's not a miracle because we expect it, and it happens every year.
Still, Rutledge says, as a contrast to the shrouds of Lent, flowers remind Christians of their belief that the crucifixion wasn't the end of the story.
If we're going to have them, and I would be very disappointed if we didn't have them on Easter morning, if we're going to have them, then by all means, let them give us the gladness that comes with the unrepeatable quality of the resurrection. Easter is looking into the grave and then saying we rejoice with the risen Christ.
And in churches as large as the National Cathedral and as small as the chapel down the street, believers say flowers mark that rejoicing.
You're pouring your heart and soul into what you're doing, as are all of my volunteers. They're looking forward to this wonderful time and praising God and nature and all the creations around us for this festival. It can't be matched.
Which is why for so many Christians, it isn't Easter Sunday morning without the flowers. I'm Kim Lawton reporting.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook And watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's also much more on our website where you can listen to or watch every program. Join us at pbs.org/religionethics. As we leave you, Easter music at the Cathedral Basilica of the Immaculate Conception in Denver.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.